Welcome to the Role Models Podcast. My name is David Noel. Have you watched the TV series Mad Men? There's an episode where an account executive drives around the office sitting on a lawnmower. Or Homeland, the TV series where there's an episode where Carrie Mathison interrogates Nicholas Brody. What both of these episodes have in common is that they were nominated for an Emmy, and they were also both directed by the very same person. And that person is Leslie Linka Glatter. She's my guest on the podcast this week. Leslie is a film and TV director and has directed countless episodes of some of your favorite TV shows. For example, Twin Peaks, Gilmore Girls, The Good Wife, The West Wing, True Blood, Mad Men, Homeland, and many, many others. In this episode, Leslie shares a number of stories of her journey from being a modern dancer to becoming an accomplished TV director. And before we jump in, here are a few housekeeping items. If you listen on Spotify, if you are a Spotify user, you can now follow and listen to the Role Models podcast on Spotify, which is great news. And a few weeks ago, we launched our Patreon page. And Patreon is a service where you, our listeners, can help support the creation of this podcast by chipping in a dollar, maybe $3 or $5 or $10 per episode. And the $10 per episode reward comes with a shout out. And here are the shout outs for this week's patrons. We have three. Number one, Megan Quinn, who was a guest on the podcast. Her shout out is to a cause that she supports called Code2040.org, a cause and organization that helps bring in more diversity into the tech industry. Anna Carolina, she's a Berlin-based coach that you can find on truthcircles.com. And then our third patron in the $10 per episode reward is Tim Herbick. Thank you to Tim. Thank you to Anna. Thank you to Megan. And thank you to all the other patrons on Patreon for making this podcast a reality. Thank you for your support. This is the Role Models Podcast. My name is David Noel. This is episode 18. And this is my guest, Leslie Linka Glatter. Leslie Linka Glatter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Good to
good
see
morning.
You.
Good morning. It's a Saturday morning, beautiful Saturday morning in Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles.
It is indeed.
And thank you for hosting me at your house.
I'm glad to have you here, Dan.
And thanks for coming on the show. Leslie, walking into the door, you asked me where I'm based, and I said, I live in Berlin. I'm originally from Belgium, but I live in Berlin. And you are a film director, accomplished and well-respected film director, and we'll dive into it. And one of the projects that you have been working on and still involved in is a TV series called Homeland.
Yes.
And season 5 is set in Berlin. So my first question would be, what's your favorite memory of Berlin as a city and as a set?
Oh, wow. Okay, I loved Berlin. I mean, it was truly an extraordinary experience being based there for the season. And one of the things for myself as a filmmaker is that it was the first time Homeland had been based in a city where we were shooting the real city for the city and the story, which means I could put the camera and all of our directors could put the camera anywhere. And Berlin visually is so exciting because of the juxtaposition between old and new and the energy of Berlin. So it was amazing to not have to pretend it was someplace else. So that opened up just a whole visual language that was thrilling. Also, Berlin is such a vibrant city. And for me, being there, it felt almost like it felt familiar in some way because I was in New York in the 80s and 90s, and it felt like everything was possible. It was a haven for dancers and musicians and artists and intellectuals and philosophers, and it's still possible to live there as an artist. So it felt like, you know, every night there are the clubs, life is just brimming everywhere. So it felt like the international city to be in. So just living there was extraordinary. And shooting there, you know, Homeland's a bit of a traveling circus. So we move, you know, from year to year. And so we have a small team that moves every year, about 10 of us. And then we embrace a whole German crew. So that cross-cultural event was a phenomenon. It was just amazing.
If you would give people a tip on what to do on their first trip to Berlin, what would you tell them?
Experience everything about the city and life there. You know, don't come in with any preconceived notions. Walk the streets. You know, I mean, I have specific places I would say you absolutely must go to, you know, whether it's the East Side Gallery, I would go to the Boros collection, you know, I would get a bike. Like the first thing I did when I moved to Berlin, because it was spring going into summer, is I bought an old bike and biked everywhere. And I felt like being on the streets, in the life, you know, stopping and having a coffee and watching the parade go by, that's what I would do.
And I also read somewhere that you do a lot of this location scouting yourself.
Yes.
In Berlin, what was something you were looking for to bring the season to life?
Well, we were looking for so many locations because we were shooting there for over 6 months. So, you know, it depended on what part of the story we were telling. But one of the things that's so amazing being a director and location scouting is you get to know a city in such a specific way. And because you're looking at the whole city as your canvas. So, I mean, we were everywhere. The strangest thing, you know, I said how lucky we were to be shooting Berlin for Berlin, which was true, but I get the second script, and in the second script, and I thought they were playing a joke on me. I thought the writers were, like, kidding with me, because it said, refugee camp, Syrian-Libya border. And I burst out laughing. I thought, they send us to Berlin, and they write refugee camp. And I thought, you know, there's no way. And of course, we have to find a refugee camp that was based at the Syrian-Libya border in Germany, which we did. We went to Rudersdorf, which, again, is a place that many people have shot. But it was, I think, Monuments Men shot there and Hunger Games. But it's an old closed-down factory, which you can make into a lot of things. So we went there, and that was extraordinary, visually extraordinary. But, you know, we were looking for, we did everything. You know, we were shot all over the city and government buildings. We shot on the street. It was a huge canvas.
I remember a scene where the character of Claire Danes sits in a cafe at the corner of Kastanienallee and Oderbergerstraße. It's around the corner of my house.
Oh, really?
It's really fun to watch a scene in a TV series. And like, I know exactly where this is.
That's
this is my
amazing.
Neighborhood. Leslie, I want to go back a little bit. I want to take you back to Tokyo in
yes.
Japan in 1981, Shibuya Station.
Yes.
Shibuya Station is one of the most crowded and also the most photographed intersections in the world. And you wrote in an L piece about a year ago in June, you started off your piece with placing the reader into Shibuya Station. What happened in Shibuya Station?
So when I was living in Japan, I was sent there to teach, choreograph, and perform modern dance throughout the Far East. So I had a completely different career before I moved into film and television. And I was standing in Shibuya Station and wanted a cup of coffee. And there were two coffee shops, one on the right, one on the left, and I very arbitrarily chose the one on the right. And needless to say, that changed my life forever because I walked in that coffee shop and it was packed with people. And there was an older Japanese man who was in his 70s who had an empty seat at the table. And he waved me over and offered me a seat. And, you know, that simple act changed my life because he turned out to be this extraordinary human being who ended up almost becoming like my Japanese father and his wife. They kind of took me in, adopted me for the time I was there. And he had been the top foreign war correspondent in Japan. He had been a Buddhist monk. He spoke 12 languages fluently. And at the time I met him, he was head of cultural affairs for the Asahi Shimbun, which was the largest newspaper, and how they did cultural affairs in Japan. So, you know, again, this was arbitrary. I sat with this man by chance. And we started talking and stayed in that coffee shop for like hours and hours, 6 hours. And eventually, you know, many, maybe 3 years later, he told me a series of stories that happened to him. And what they had in common is they all happened during different wars, about human connection and all on Christmas Eve, even though he was Buddhist. And the stories were amazing. And I knew I had to pass them on, and I knew it wasn't dance. So that was the beginning of the thought process that led me to direct my first film.
And before we jump into film direction, you mentioned you had a different career.
Yes.
As a modern dancer and choreographer. What was the decision to make that transition?
It was those stories.
Those stories.
Like, it literally, it wasn't like I was looking to change careers. I loved what I was doing. I love dance. I love the immediacy of dance, and that you can get an idea and go to the studio and work it out and, you know, with a minimum of finance, go and do it. Film is not that way. I mean, it's become a little more that way because now you can pick up your cell phone and tell a story. But, you know, when I started, that was not the case. And I think one of the things that's amazing about coming from dance is that you can't cheat. Your leg goes up in the air or it doesn't. It doesn't matter what you tell people about how great you are. They're going to know the truth in a matter of seconds. You know? And so I think with changing careers, I think, you know, you have to come in with what you know and then be totally open to what you need to learn about this new medium. And that's what I did. You know, I thrust myself into learning everything I could about directing in film.
How did you get into modern dance?
My mother. My mother was a modern dancer, and she trained with Martha Graham, Hanya Holm, Alwyn Nicolai, performed all over. And so I started with her. Her name is Toni Beck, and she's an extraordinary person, and definitely made it clear to me as I was growing up that I could do whatever I wanted if I worked really hard at it.
Where are you from?
I was born, so my parents are both from New York City, but my dad was a labor organizer for the Women's Garment Union. So I was born in Texas because they were both down south organizing factories.
And so how was this growing up between Texas and New York, which are two
insane
different places.
Insane.
What are some of the things there that influenced or shaped who you are today?
You know, that's a great question. When I grew up in Dallas, Texas, it was very, very conservative. And I grew up in a very liberal family. So it was, you know, now it sounds very interesting when I tell people stories of when I was growing up there, but it was really hard. It was hard being such an outsider. And I think you develop a rich inner life because you have to. And, you know, we'd go back and forth between New York and Texas. So I'd kind of feel like, how normal do you feel when you're growing up? Like, growing up, you know, is complicated no matter where you are, you know, and everyone goes through that process of developing. And, you know, you feel like no one has ever felt so deeply or loved so profoundly or felt so isolated. And then you find out that, of course, everyone feels exactly the same way. And it's a totally universal process. So, you know, it felt like being yanked it from one extreme to the other. So I think in Texas, I developed a way to survive by, you know, I was doing Antonin Artaud plays at night after school. And then I was a Texas cheerleader. You know, so I had like almost a split personality there. So I had to at some point figure out how to meld those two things together to become a complete human being, which I'm still working at.
If in hindsight you look back and say, okay, this time has shaped me in many different ways, what's the one learning that you can place back to that time that you would still apply today?
I would say learning how to trust your own instincts, and stay true to that.
How have you trained that? How do you exercise that?
You know, for me, I move pretty quickly through things and I have a lot of energy. I think you at some point have to stop. I lived overseas for 10 years, 11 years in Europe and in Asia when I was dancing. And I think at that point, I felt that the answers to everything would be out there somewhere. It would be, you know, on a mountain in Kathmandu or, you know, studying with the Aborigines in Australia. It was out there. And I think when I finally realized, you know what, it's not out there, it's somewhere inside me, that there has to be a balance between the two. So I think it's somehow finding that balance in your life. And, you know, what I've learned as a director, and this is because now I've been doing it a long time and I feel like I can trust those instincts more, is if I can quiet all the noise and just be really in the moment, that is the best possible place to work from. And, you know, now I plan everything, but I'm open to the magic that happens in the moment. Like, I hope the actors come in with something I could have never thought of alone in a room, but I know I have a plan if that doesn't happen.
So do you, to create that balance, do you have, and to quiet the noise, do you have developed a practice that works well for you to...
I meditate every day.
You meditate, okay.
So that's something I started, you know, I was living in Japan, so I started when I was young, and it's something I've continued, and that helps me a lot.
What kind of meditation?
When I was very young, 18, I took a course in transcendental meditation because that was kind of the thing that was going on then. But then I went and studied Zen in various temples when I was living in Japan. So I think I probably do some version of my own mix that I've been doing for a long time. So it's not a particular practice, but it's a way to silence myself.
I struggle with meditation. I have on and off.
Yes.
And how have you found value in it over a sustained period of time?
Well, I guess I've just learned that when I don't do it, when I'm not rigorous about that practice, I see the difference. You know, I'm thrown off my center because working in film, you have to, it's like there are every day on a set, there are thousands of questions that happen. And you have to be able to make decisions very quickly and try to assess a situation and make something that looks like it's a disaster into an opportunity. And I find if I'm not really centered, I don't make the best decisions. Yeah, so I found that if I don't do it, the results are very bad. So that's what makes me do it.
How do you make decisions?
Again, I try to be in the moment and assess the situation and make the choice that seems the best in the moment. I'm not a soothsayer. I'm not a psychic, so I can only like look at what I have with all the information available.
Have you developed a decision-making framework for yourself, or is this more something that you follow by intuition?
It's intuition combined with many years of directing.
So the skill, the yes. practice, the expertise,
like one of the
subject matter expertise.
You have to know the craft. Like, I don't believe you can just come in and work off of intuition. I think you have to be open to that and know what that is and have the channels open. But there is a craft to directing. I think you need to know what and why every person on that set is doing so that you can tell the best possible story. I mean, we're storytellers in a collaborative medium. And I love being a storyteller in this medium, but you really need to know what the craft is. And, you know, and everyone comes in with different skills. Like I came in from being a dancer, so moving people through space and blocking scenes, that felt very natural to me. But even though I had directed theater, I went immediately back to study acting because I needed to know the vocabulary to talk to an actor to help them find the truth of a scene. And I didn't really know about lenses and photography, so I went and studied that. How does a long lens make you feel emotionally? Why would you use that versus a wide-angle lens? Those are things, and where do you put the camera in a scene? I don't feel that's your cinematographer's choice. I think you need to know why you're making that choice, and then talking to your cinematographer is only going to add more to what the scene is. But as a director, I think you need to consciously make choices. So I feel like if you're starting out, learn everything you can, and then trust your instincts.
What would you, and I want to go back to how you got into film directing and transition from dance and choreography. But if you would share advice for someone who has the desire or ambition to go into film directing, like what would you tell them? What is something that you found to be more important to focus on versus other things?
Well, I think it's a combination of things because, again, it's one of those practices that you need all sorts of skill sets, you know. So, you know, I think, again, learning the craft, knowing what everyone does on a set so you can utilize all the incredible creative talents of your team. You know, I want to know what I want, but and how to approach a story. So first you need to understand story. I would say that's the first primary thing. And when you read a script, what is the story about? What is the subtext? What are different characters' point of view in that story? Because you're only going to have a certain amount of time to shoot, so you better know what to spend time on. So story is everything, and character is everything. Because if you don't care about the people, ultimately the story doesn't work. Like if it could be shot, it could be the most beautiful looking thing ever, but if you don't have any emotional truth, it's only going to be a beautiful image. So it's what I love about film. It's this marriage of all of these things. So I think you have to learn your craft and learn all the different components, and then having a clean way to trust your own instincts about the story. I think you also have to be very tenacious. It's not an easy path. And you have to know that no matter how many people say it's impossible, you can't do this, that you just put blinders on and keep going. And I think within that, you know, again, it's a difficult business. You have to remember the joy. You have to remember that you love telling stories, because being tenacious can kind of harden your creative spirit. So you have to keep the joy alive at the same time.
How have you trained and exercised to be tenacious? So you said it's not an easy path, requires a lot of determination and patience and hard work, trust in your instinct. How have you remained focused on following the path and not let yourself distract or get away from that path?
I think that you're going to get many, many no's, but it only takes one yes to make it happen. And you don't know where that yes is going to be. So I think it's just, if this is what you have to do, you know, and I don't think, it's not for the faint of heart. So I think you have to know that this is the path you have to take, that that's what you're going to do. Nothing is going to deter you from that. You know, and if it does, it probably isn't the right path for you. Yeah, so I think you just, until you get the yes, or make it happen yourself. Don't wait for someone to give you permission to do it. You know, now we are in a time that you can pick up a camera and tell a story. So you don't need, you know, when I started, you were shooting film, you know, it had to be developed, it had to be processed. It was expensive. It wasn't like a hobby you could pick up and just experiment. You know, you really had to have some cash, even if you're doing a small, tiny little thing. And now that's a different world. I think about, I've mentored a lot of women directors and men too, but I mean, it's still much harder for women. And I don't think, you know, again, it's not an easy path for anyone, but it should be equal. You know, it shouldn't be harder for our daughters to direct than for our sons. It should be the same. So an assistant of mine a number of years ago was frustrated. She was a director. She couldn't get anything going. She made a good student film, but it just didn't take off because sometimes it's timing and all sorts of things. And, you know, I said to her, just pick up a camera and go tell a story. You know, get those creative juices going. So she started a web series. And she spent $100 a month on shooting this web series. And after a couple of years, it became like this phenomenon. And hundreds and thousands of people were watching this. And she's now directed her fifth movie. You know, and it happened because she just did it. She didn't wait for someone to say, oh, come direct my show. She made her own show. And I think that's the world we're in now.
Yeah, it sounds like we're in a very different world for creators today, where the barriers are way lower to start creating and then distributing, building an audience, connecting with an audience. So the times today are very different for creators, thanks to platforms like Vimeo or YouTube and others.
Now, getting through the noise and how tons of material out there, that can be the difficulty now, so because there's so much storytelling. But there's no secret, you know, path to that.
Yeah.
I mean, some things get discovered and some things don't. And unfortunately, you know, there's no advice for that. You just have to make it and try to get it out there as best you can.
So the barriers are lower today, and they weren't as low. They were way higher when you entered the film directing as a film director. How did you break through those barriers?
I made my first short film. I did that through a program at the American Film Institute called the Directing Workshop for Women. I applied to the program. I was completely unqualified to be in this program. The program was set up for women in the film business who hadn't directed, but I wasn't in the film business. I was a choreographer and dancer, but I just applied anyway. I thought it was a good reason for me to put my ideas down on paper, to actually write the script, which I did with a co-writer friend by the name of Cindy Carr. And it just was like the excuse and reason to write the script and figure out what is it I wanted to tell. So I did that and applied and got in. So that was a very lucky moment. And, you know, part of this is you have to have a lot of tenacity, hopefully some sort of talent, and a little bit of luck. Somewhere there has to be a door that opens, and then you move through it. And you have to be aware that the door is opening, and then you have to, you know, actually do a good job once it's open. But you do need a helping hand. There's somewhere something has to happen. And I had that window of opportunity, and fortunately I took it. And so I got in this program, and I realized I didn't know anything about working in film. So I worked on, I think there were 10 of us in the program, and I worked on all of the other women's films so I could learn about the process before I went and directed my own film. So that's what I did.
And that first film actually went and won an Oscar.
Well, it was nominated.
Nominated,
which
sorry.
Was a total insane phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know,
so your first project.
Yes. Huh? And it was everything I was told not to do if I wanted a job in film. But I didn't care because I wasn't looking to change careers. I wasn't looking for a job. I wanted to tell my mentor stories. And so the film was 3/4 in Japanese. It had flashbacks, narration, was a period piece set in World War II, and it had one Caucasian character in it. So, you know, in commercial filmmaking, that's a total recipe for disaster. There was nothing commercial about this. But I didn't care. I wanted to tell the stories, and that's what I did.
And so that sounds like another lucky moment in a way, right?
A lucky moment, but that's another thing, is be passionate about the story you're telling. Don't tell a story that you think people are going to want to see. Tell a story that you really care about, that you understand, that moves you, that you have a point of view about. And that is something that has shaped my whole career.
And so that basically kickstarted your career, right?
Yes.
What are some of the early... So just to place ourselves in time, on a timeline there, this was early 90s, late 80s?
No, this was, I made the film in the mid-80s.
Mid-80s.
And I still, you know, I was still a modern dancer, I was still choreographing, so I kind of did both things for a while, and then eventually realized, no, you can't really do both of these things simultaneously.
At what point did you go full-time, all-in on the film directing? Was this a process or a moment? Decision making. What was the evolution into the full time?
So after the film, the film was called Tales of Meeting and Parting, and it was a 30-minute film. So it was nominated for Best Short Film, and after that film was nominated, I started getting a lot of calls, you know, meaning agents and producers. And again, this was a world I knew nothing about. I didn't have connections in the film business. I came from an art dance background. So it wasn't like a world I knew anything about. So learning about kind of Hollywood was a totally new experience, and not always a positive one for me. Like, I was much more comfortable in the art world. And so that was a learning experience as well. But after the film was nominated, I did sign with an agency, which was kind of crazy. And then I got a call from Steven Spielberg. How insane is that?
That is insane.
So, you know, again, you have this window of opportunity. The film was nominated, so people are going to see it, and you have that one moment to take advantage of, because next week there's going to be another slew of young directors. So I realized, you know what? It's asparagus season, and you're an asparagus. You know, and pretty soon next week it's going to be carrot season, and no one will want to know anything about asparagus. So you better take that moment of opportunity. So I got this call, and I thought it was a prank call.
What was it like? Where were you?
I was at my apartment on Melrose. I mean, near the Melrose Avenue part of Los Angeles, and I had a couple of roommates. And I got a call. I thought it was a friend, you know, joking, you know, because I had just done this film, and I hung up. And it turned out it was Steven Spielberg, and he had seen my short film on a plane and wanted me to come in for a meeting. I was like, what? Thank God he called back. So I went in to meet with him, and he's an extraordinary human being. I mean, he was my first mentor. I've had amazing mentors in my life, and I think it's why I'm so committed to mentoring other directors. So he had a show at the time called Amazing Stories, and it was an anthology series, and he was hiring all his friends to direct, but he decided within that he was going to mentor three new directors, and it was myself, Todd Holland, who is still a friend, and Phil Joanneau. So we were the newbies in all of this, with these extraordinary other directors, ranging from Clint Eastwood to Martin Scorsese. That was like my film school. You know, I came from doing this short film. That was the only experience I had. And I wanted to take advantage of absolutely, you know, everything that was around me. So I asked Steven, can I shadow him? Can I mentor with him and maybe one other director before I actually directed? So I did something similar that I did with the American Film Institute. I made a choice to observe and to learn before I jumped in myself. Because again, I realized this was just not my field. You know, and I had only done one thing. So I wanted to be sure I was properly armed with information. So that's what I did. So I shadowed Steven, and then I shadowed Clint Eastwood. Can you imagine? You know, two icons. And they directed completely differently. They were like night and day. So what I learned from that is there's no one right way. You have to figure out what your way is. But they are both very conscious directors. So I realized, you know, I need to know what I want. And what I want is going to be based in story. So that's kind of where that lesson came from.
Amazing. So you mentioned that Steven Spielberg, Clint Eastwood, others became your mentors. At the beginning of your career, where you weren't really an established film director yet. And so can you talk a little bit about the importance of mentors, and those mentors maybe in particular, during that time? And then also what makes a great mentor and a great mentee?
Right.
So that's, I think, we talk a lot about mentors and what they do for us, or in what way they help us. But it'd be also great for our audience and listeners to hear, like, what makes a good mentee? How can you be a good mentee?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I am very involved in mentoring directors, but that relationship has to happen naturally. You can't, like, I've gotten emails from people I've never met saying, will you mentor me? Unfortunately, that's not how it happens. It has to be an organic situation where you both recognize in each other the beginning of this relationship. It can't be something that you force. You know, so that's a very tricky one. Like, I don't think you can go looking for a mentor. I think it has to kind of happen in some way. And I know that's not answering the question, like, where do you get a mentor? Like, it, you know, I didn't call up Steven Spielberg and say, will you mentor me? Because I don't know how you do that. So it came out of getting to know each other and what the relationship was. And he did something so unbelievably generous to me very early on as a new director. So two things, you know, one piece of advice, and then when I had a total stress dream, how he dealt with it. So, you know, one of the things we were talking about instincts. So I was lucky enough to be able to spend time with him because I asked to shadow him. So that was, for me, very important because I was able to spend time with him and see how does he work on a set? How does he come up with an idea of how to shoot something? And we were talking one day on the set. He was directing his Amazing Stories with Kevin Costner. And he said, you know, when you're watching a scene and something's not working and your instincts tell you that, you know, they go screaming in your head, this isn't right. This doesn't make sense. You need to listen to that. And it could be anything. It could be there's something wrong with the blocking. You haven't really figured out what the scene is about. Maybe it's the dialogue. It could be anything. But if you tell your instincts to shut up, they will. And they won't talk to you anymore about that scene. So keep that channel open at all times to your instincts because they will protect you. And then when I was like several days away from shooting. And I had the worst possible stress dream. I mean, like nightmare. Like actors have stress dreams where they come out on stage and they're naked. So as a director, I had like the classic director's stress dream. I dreamed that I got to the set and it was a set I'd never seen. It was a stage filled with pea green sofas. You know, and I was directing a war story, so it had nothing to do with the story I was telling. There was a crew already shooting who I had never seen before, and they were in the middle of shooting. They were already shooting, and I'm like, oh my goodness, what the hell? So I go up to someone, I go, hi, I'm Leslie, I am supposed to be directing this. And they're like, oh, that's great that you're here. Well, we're about to break for lunch, and you could go look at dailies. And I'm like, what? So I go look at these dailies. And they're horrifying. And I still have no idea what the story is. It's not the story I've prepared. And then as soon as I've seen all this terrible footage of quivering mouths and close-ups of eyeballs, they tell me I have to go back and start shooting again. So, you know, I woke up in a cold sweat. And what do? I tell this to Steven Spielberg the next day, and I'm like, here's the one guy who has believed in me, and he's giving me a chance, and I'm telling him this like horrible stress dream. And I still don't know to this day whether he was just being nice to me or it was true, but he leaned in and he said, I have that dream before I start every project. What a beautiful thing to do for a young director. You know, and I still don't know if that's true. I was able to thank him publicly last year, which was an amazing thing. It like completes things, you know, full circle in some way. But, you know, I think you need to know that every time you start something new as a creative person, you're going to be panicked. And somehow if you're not panicked, you're probably not on your game because you're always risking something every time you start out again, no matter how long you've been doing it. Is that there's always that you're putting something on the line.
Yeah, I think that's a really great piece of advice that I've experienced similarly in terms of public speaking or speaking to larger crowds and in my case, to a company of 400 people. And even though I would consider myself a confident public speaker and who has done it many times, I'm still nervous every single time before I go on stage.
Sure.
And I think sharing that with people who are less experienced in public speaking is a useful way to say that this feeling will never go away.
It will always be there.
And you just need to find a way to play with that.
Yes.
And use it to your advantage. And
that is so true, David. I think it's in every field. It's like, you know, don't try to make it stop. You'll learn how to deal with it better, but it will be there. I mean, in fact, like I have a dear friend who, you know, usually it's like my third or fourth day of prep where I come in and go, I have no ideas. I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't understand this. This is a disaster. They'll find out I don't know anything, that, you know, the last 25 years have just been luck, and now they're going to know I don't know what I'm doing. And that happens every project. And then all of a sudden, I start to jump into the story and understand the story and know what my point of view about telling the story is, and then it's okay again. But that energy never goes away.
I want to talk a little bit about the profession of directing, mm-hmm. or the art of directing. And you are a very experienced, accomplished director. You've directed series like Twin Peaks, which is coming back now.
Yes.
You've directed Homeland, which we've talked about. The West Wing, which I would love to talk about as well. Gilmore Girls, The OC. I mean, all of our favorite shows throughout the last 20, 30 years, you somehow have been involved, which is fascinating. And I would be curious to know, in this like 30 plus year career as a film director, responsible for bringing some of the best stories to television and to film, what has been your key learning in bringing a screenplay to life?
I think one of the things with being director is making choices of the material that you want to direct. And for me, and I think it's coming from dance and not having, you know, dance, you don't go into dance to make money. You go into dance because you love it. So I don't think I was as aware of this when I was starting out, but I've now been able to, by the virtue of time, look back and realize how I made choices. If I didn't relate to the material, I couldn't do it. Like, I would read a script, and if I thought it was stupid, I couldn't do it. And I know many other directors who have had huge, fabulous careers who could just take the job. But I was never that person. So I could only kind of take things that I felt like I had a point of view about or understood. So now, since I've been doing this a long time, I realized for me, and there's no one right way to make choices. Like, everyone you talk to in film and television has a totally different path. So there's not one right way to proceed. But for me, I made the only choice I could was I needed to relate to the material. And that's the choices I made. So now, yes, I've had a few jobs that were terrible and bad choices, but you don't know that going in. You think it's going to be good and it doesn't turn out good. But for the most part, I picked things that I related to and they were really great. But it wasn't because I picked them. It was just that's what I related to.
How do you select? So you probably have a large pool of stories coming, surfacing, yes, to you at any given time. So how do you choose a story that you want to bring to life, to the screen?
It's just either I read it and I see it, or I don't. And if I, you know, I've read things that I thought were fantastic, but I didn't think I was the right person to do it. You know, it's something I would want to go see, you know. I mean, and this is, let's say, a commercial film. I was sent the script of Legally Blonde, you know, to see if I was interested in directing it. And I read the script, and I didn't get it. I didn't get it at all. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was kind of condescending to women. But I went to see the film, and I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was so much fun. Now, thank goodness I passed on that, because it would have been absolutely terrible had I taken it. But Peyton Reed, who directed it, I think it was Peyton Reed. Yes, that's right. Did an amazing job. I hope I have the right director, because I'm giving credit to someone. But whoever directed that film, and I don't have my phone to look up IMDb, did a perfect job. They were the right director for the project. I would have been a total disaster. It would have been an abysmal failure. So I think you need to know for yourself, what do you relate to? What stories do you want to tell? And that you have a point of view about it. So, and I think I trusted that pretty young. You know, last night was the premiere of the new Twin Peaks, and it was extraordinary. And I was lucky enough early on to direct four of the original Twin Peaks. And that was a game changer, I think, both in television storytelling as well as for me as an artist. And it was like being at a high school reunion. I hadn't seen many of these people that I had worked with in 25 years, you know, and it was like going back to the school that you had the best time with, people that you adored and you hadn't seen, and it was amazing. And I just, it was a huge point in my life and career doing that show.
Well, if you can bring back the West Wing, I would be.
I know, totally. Right. I mean, all of us, I run into people that worked on that show all the time who are dear friends, like the amazing director Tommy Schlamme, Aaron Sorkin, and directors that Alex Graves and Chris Messiano, who were their executive producer directors on that show. And we all go, my God, that was an amazing moment in time. How lucky that we were part of that.
Do you know this podcast, The West Wing Weekly?
You know what? I have not listened to it, and I've heard it's amazing.
It is my favorite podcast.
Oh, really? I have to start listening to it.
So this is Joshua Malina.
Yes, who is great.
And Rishi, I can't pronounce his last name. They go through each episode of The West Wing. They're now at season, I think they're at season 3, episode 6, about there. And it's amazing.
Oh my goodness.
You relive the entire story.
I have just heard about that because I'm just totally getting into podcasts and listening all the time. So, you know, I'm definitely going to embrace that one.
I watched 2 episodes that you directed last night.
Oh, of what show?
The first one was Homeland.
Yes.
The episode called Q&A.
Yes.
Which is an episode you were nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Drama Directing. And it's episode 5 of season 2. And I also watched the first episode that you directed of The West Wing called Election Night.
Yes.
Which is episode 7 of season 4. So in Q&A, there's the pivotal scene of the episode is when character of Claire Danes, Kerry Matheson, grills a character of Damian Lewis, Nicholas Brody, and basically cracks him. And it's almost like a 5-minute monologue by Claire Danes, and it starts on the same eye level. And at the end of the monologue, Damian Lewis lays on the table, mm-hmm. and he cracks. I found that a really interesting dynamic in terms of directing, which we can talk about. And then contrast this with the episode in The West Wing, where for me the pivotal scene is the president, President Bartlet, Martin Sheen, coming into the Oval Office, and his secretary, Debbie Fitterer, arranges his phone, and it just had come out that his MS was manifesting itself. And in the scene, the secretary of the president takes authority over the president, which was a very interesting dynamic as well. So those are 2 episodes, and I only have limited view on the 2 episodes, not all of them that you created, but in both episodes, I realized that there were 2 female characters who were very powerful. Is there a connection there? Can you talk more about that?
That's a really interesting question, David. I don't know that it's a conscious connection. It might be very subconscious. I'm definitely interested in complicated characters, complicated female characters, where they're as layered and interesting and complex as men. You know, I feel like men and women are different, but both extraordinary. I suppose when I came of age as a young person, I thought, oh, men and women are the same. But once I had a child and I had a male child, I realized, no, you know what, we're actually really different, but equally fascinating. I've loved being on Homeland, which, you know, as its heart has this very interesting, flawed, complicated character. And starting off with Q&A as the first episode of Homeland that I directed, I panicked because I got the script and it was 40 pages in one room. It was an interrogation scene with Carrie Matheson and Nicholas Brody. And you have a character, Brody, who has been captured and interrogated and tortured for 8 years. So someone who is very used to being questioned, and you have a CIA agent who is used to questioning. So they are both incredibly skilled at this. And how are you going to, even though that was a very long scene, how are you going to credibly believe that in this time they do this dance together and that she is going to break someone who has been very used to being questioned? And what are going to be those turning points? Because they're very different for each character in the scene. So you have to know, again, what's important about the scene for each character's point of view. And then you marry it together. So working with those two brilliant actors on that scene was a truly extraordinary experience, because it was almost like doing a play. Like, you know, I thought very seriously, how do you shoot this? Because if they have to do this scene over and over again, or I have to shoot all of Claire, and what if Damien is amazing off camera, and then by the time I turn around and light the other side and shoot Damien, you know, he's already done the scene. So I worked with the DP, and we cross-covered the scene. So we were doing both of their coverage at the same time. So it made the dynamics very thrilling. You know, yes, they had to do it many times in different sizes, and you know, but the bulk of the material was shot simultaneously, you know, so that you were getting the freshness of the question and response simultaneously. Yeah.
In the there's a piece that you wrote that I referenced earlier in Elle magazine online. And there's two photos in that scene. One photo, and I'm looking at it right now. This is, I think, during that scene between Nicholas Brody and Carrie Matheson in this integration, where you are connected to Damian Lewis as an actor. And there's another photo where you are in a connection with Claire Danes. And in both of these photos, there's such a deep connection between you and as a director and the respective actor. Talk a little about establishing that connection and a relationship to an actor that you direct.
I think that's a great question. I think you first have to understand the scene very clearly and understand what each character wants in that scene. And I start off, even though I planned out what I'm doing, I always want to know what the actors are going to bring to it that I could have never thought of while I'm planning. So I want to leave that first rehearsal completely open to see what they bring to it. And then I respond in the moment from what I'm seeing, you know. And I think you need to know very carefully, and that was a very carefully constructed scene. What are those turning points for the actors? Now, some of those things they're going to immediately go to, because these two actors are brilliant. And then if it's not clear, you talk about the shape of it. Like, this is a point that changes the dynamic of the scene, you know. So I think you need to be very clear about what that is. You need to have done your homework. And don't say too much. Don't feel like you have to talk. You know, say what's necessary, but not more. You know, and I think doing that kind of scene, a scene with those kind of actors, is a very intimate experience. You know, and I think you have to respect that experience. You know, I've now worked with both of these actors quite a lot. Unfortunately, I had to kill Damien in the end of season 3, which was tragic. And I miss him all the time. But working with Claire Danes the last many years has made me a more fearless director. She is an extraordinary human being and an extraordinary talent, and will go anywhere. So again, it's respecting the process, you know, and really seeing what's going on.
Let's talk about skills. Your role and responsibility as a film director, the way I've imagined it is, and you can talk more to it, is that you set the vision for the scene, the episode, the season, or the film, and then you rally all components, all contributors, whether it's creative or it's business or it's technical, to execute on that vision. What are some of the skills that you've developed over that time to be an effective film director when it comes to balancing, managing all these different components and aspects to the role?
You know, it requires a lot of different skill sets that sometimes don't feel like that are connected in some way, because I think you have to be a bit of a chameleon. Because you might need to be mom or dad, stern dad, compassionate mom, therapist, best friend, you know, tough boss. You're going to need to use all of those skills, you know, to be able to do the job well. I think, you know, going back to that last question, I think with working with actors, you want to be sure you're not giving them directions of results. That it's, you want to be sure you're giving directions that help with their process. Because if you say, be sad, you know, be more sad, you're going to get something that's very superficial, you know, or cry. Because crying, usually you cry when you don't want to cry. It's not because you want to cry. You're usually trying to stop yourself from crying. So you don't want just a superficial response. You want to be sure you're not giving result-oriented direction. It has to be process.
Yeah. What do you do then instead? How do you direct around?
I would
process?
Do. Let's say if you want someone to cry, you know, and they immediately burst out into tears, I would give the direction: do that, but keep it all inside. Try to stop yourself from crying. That is usually going to make a scene where you feel more for the actor. If the actor is just emoting, you feel less. You know, if someone's trying to struggle to not cry, that would be more compelling for the audience. Yeah. So, you know, I think it depends on the scene, obviously, but that's an example. You know, as a director, you have to impart, I've been an executive producer on a multiple series as well as a director. And that I think has helped me become a better director because I understand what's important for production. Because being a director in film and TV, you need to understand how something gets made, you know, and to be conscious of that. And because you're working with so many different creative areas, like when you go on a tech scout, which means when you go to tell the crew what you're planning on doing, you need to have worked that out. Because somebody who's in charge of transportation, where the trucks are going to be parked, if you don't tell them which way you're looking in the scene, the trucks could all be in your shot. Now, that sounds like something really silly, but if you get to the set and all of the vehicles are parked in the middle of your shot, you will lose hours of your day. So it's a team sport, and you want to put the best possible team together so you are going to be able to tell your story in the best way. And then use the people who are experts in that field. Like if I'm doing a dangerous stunt sequence, action sequence, you better listen to your stunt coordinator because you don't want to do anything dangerous that's going to harm an actor or a stunt person. So you could have planned something and then they tell you, you know what? I can't let you do that. I can't let the motorcycle slide under that truck. You know, we're going to have to do that in a different way. Well, you better listen to that because you are responsible for people's well-being on the set. And that's a huge responsibility. So they're with directing, there's so many different elements. And you hire experts in all the different departments to help you with that vision. But you need to have the vision.
What is one skill, foundational skill as a film director that you have found to be a skill that you learn early on in learning the craft, but that you transport, that you port into every phase of your career?
Don't pretend to know something that you don't, because you will get caught. You know, someone is going to know how to do it, and you will get caught, but you also won't learn what you need to know for the next time this comes up. There's no harm in not knowing something. You know, and you can say, you can have a vision for something but not know how to do something. If you haven't used a certain kind of insert car, don't pretend because you want to be an expert, you know, to know that. Say, listen, you know, this is what I think the scene's about, but I haven't done that before. What do you think the best way to do that is? You know, and then you're going to get a willing collaborator, you know, who's going to help you learn how to do it, and then you'll know that for the next time.
So asking for help is...
Asking for help, but knowing what you want, knowing what the bigger picture is, and then being sure, I don't want to be the smartest person in the room, but I want to be in the room with the smartest people.
I opened up a browser yesterday and typed in into Google, I typed in film director. And what Google does, it gives you like a grid view of film directors, photos of film directors. And you appear in that first list, but that list is very male dominated.
Yes.
Why aren't there more female film directors at your level with your level of experience?
Wow. That's the $64,000 question. It makes no sense to me because I think women are unbelievably suited for directing. I don't think it's a gender issue. I think, you know, it's somehow women have been typecast into a certain kind of film that they direct, and, you know, which is ludicrous because, of course, male directors can direct romantic comedies and emotional scenes as well as action. And I feel that women are exactly the same way. It's not a gender issue. I don't represent all women. I can only represent me. Like people have said, you know, what is a female director's point of view? Well, I can't give, you know, or I can't, I've never been a male director, so I can't give that point of view, but I certainly don't represent my whole gender. I just represent me. So, you know, again, I've mentored a lot of women directors. It, again, it doesn't make any sense that this has stayed so much a primarily male field. I think because it's somehow the last holdout. You know, there have been huge strides made in writing and producing for women, but somehow directing, being the captain of the ship on a set where you have a huge, you know, 100-person, 150-person crew, and, you know, it's just been the last holdout, and I think that's changing. It should change. Again, I feel like it should be an equal playing field. You know, women can direct action, men can direct emotion. It's not about that. It's about telling a story. So I think it's become a dialogue that's in the public zeitgeist now, and I believe it will change. But if you had asked me 25 years ago when I started directing, would we still be discussing this? I would have said absolutely not. It will have changed. This won't be an issue in 2017. And the fact that it still is shocking to me in a creative field. You would think that we would be doing better in film and television than the United States government is in diversity.
What are some of the mistakes, or you mentor, and you're contributing to that change by actively mentoring women directors? What is some of the mistakes that you see directors, young directors, do early in their career, and what can they do to prevent those mistakes from developing over time?
I think some of the things is, you know, you, even if you've never done it, you can try to be prepared. You can be prepared. You know, so I don't think there's any excuse for anyone to come in and not have done your homework, you know. But again, be open to the huge amount of professionals that are around you. So I think, again, you need to be prepared, but be open at the same time. I've heard, you know, when you talk to crew and they assess a director's skill, which is not always fair, but it's only from their point of view. If someone comes in and says, so what scene are we shooting today? That is unacceptable. You know, you need to come in and have really thought about the work that you're doing for the day, you know, because the crew will come together and shoot something. You know, because that's their job. But you need to as a director and even a first-time director, do your homework. Know what you want, but be open to all the amazing people around you. Don't be just steadfast in your vision, because that's missing out on all the people who are truly there to help you create your vision. And you're going to learn something from them. I feel the best idea wins. And you want to, like I've had experiences being on the set were one of the guys who's an electrician, you know, who helps light the set. And, you know, because I hope to create a good working environment on the set where people can offer an idea. You always have the choice to say no thank you. But he was on top of a building, setting lights. And he yelled down, "Hey, Les, you should see what this looks like from up here. It's amazing." So I crawl up the ladder up to the fifth floor of a building. And I look down. I'm like, "Oh my God, this is incredible. Thank you so much, Joey. You know, let's bring D camera up here and put a camera up here." And he felt great. It was a great idea. And if I hadn't been open to that moment, I would have missed it. And if I had shut him down on some other thing, he wouldn't have felt comfortable to offer that suggestion. And if it wasn't good, I would have said, "Thanks so much. Great idea. It doesn't really work for this scene." You know, you don't have to do it. But, you know, to me, that's what makes it a creative experience. So I would say be prepared and be open.
Well, I have two more questions and then we need to wrap up. This is the Role Models podcast.
Yes.
Do you have a role model?
I have many role models. I have many role models. So not just one. Certainly the incredible directors that allowed me to shadow them, to learn from their process, like Steven Spielberg and David Lynch. But I feel like I meet mentors all the time, people who have skills in so many different fields and be open to learning. I think it's not just learning about your own field, but it's learning about life, learning about politics, learning about religions and philosophy. I think, you know, to tell good stories, you have to have lived life. So, you know, I think you want to be open to all sorts of mentors. I mean, Yutaka Tsuji, who was my mentor in Japan, you know, he had nothing to do with directing or the arts, but he was like my life mentor. So I think they come in all shapes and forms. Another huge mentor for me was a South African writer by the name of Sir Lawrence Vanderpost. And he's no longer, both of these men are no longer with us. But when I was I was living in Japan, so I was still a choreographer. I read his books, and he was Carl Jung's best friend. He wrote about the Kalahari Desert, the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert. He started one of the first anti-apartheid magazines in South Africa and was banned and had to move to England. Just an extraordinary writer. And he was captured by the Japanese in World War II and wrote a book about that experience, which was amazing, called The Sword and the Chrysanthemum. I think that was the name of it. It was made into the movie Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. But his understanding about the Japanese spirit and humanity and the horror that the men suffered being in that camp, but the kind of generosity of spirit, of humanity, was profound. And so I wrote him a letter just out of the blue. I'd never done that before. I was like 22 years old. And for whatever reasons, he wrote me back. And we developed a correspondence. And then I flew to England to meet him. And he became also a profound life mentor for me, he and his wife.
What advice would you give to your 14-year-old self?
God, 14-year-old self.
16, 20, you choose.
God, 14-year-old self, boy. It will get better. Keep going. Trust that it's a long journey, you know, and keep learning and be open to life and experiences. Don't be so scared.
Leslie, I want to thank you for your generosity in spending time with me on a Saturday morning here in your house. Thank you for welcoming me, for opening that door to me, and I hope that we will see many, many more episodes and films that you bring to life to the screen. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, David.
Thank you to Leslie for taking the time to share her story on the podcast, and thanks to you for taking the time to listen. Apologies to Hrishikesh Hirway for mispronouncing your name. And if you liked this episode, then why not check out one of the previous episodes? We've had on the show Samin Nosrat, who is a chef turned author turned teacher, who talks about the creation of her book, Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat. Or Kara Swisher, who is one of the most respected technology journalists in the industry. Or maybe Cindy Gallup, who is an outspoken advocate for bringing more diversity into the business and advertising world. If you liked this episode and you want to support the Role Models podcast, you can do this by going on iTunes, posting a short review with some feedback that you have. Maybe click 5 stars as well while you're at there. And if you want to do more, you can become a patron on patreon.com/role models and chip in $1, $3, $5, or $10 and receive some really cool rewards in return. Thank you for being a listener. Thanks for making all the way till the end of this podcast. And until then, until next time, thank you.